You're listening to the Adam Tracy Underground Podcast, where it's not always advisable, but it is always endorsed.
Hi, everybody. Again, this is Adam Tracy. This is the Adam Tracy Underground Podcast. And today I have with me the very powerful John, who has a great story to tell. And John, you were in the Merchant Marine Corps. Is that correct?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. All right. And for those who aren't totally familiar with it, because there's a Merchant Marine Academy, and I know that, the Merchant Marines teaches you to do what, right? Like, you are effectively a...
Merchant Marine is commercial shipping.
Right.
It used to be Department of Defense, but Ronald Reagan made it Department of Transportation. And that's when I first started, was in 1980. And it had just gone from Department of Defense to Department of Transportation. And so I started as a deckhand on board an offshore supply boat out of Louisiana. And I did that for a few months, but Louisiana really sucks. So... I got a job. The only good thing about Louisiana is they have great whorehouses. That's the rest of the state they can keep. New Orleans is great. I mean, but I'm talking working in the freaking bayou, you know.
Yeah.
That's just like shithole. And so anyway, so I started doing that, working on the supply boats as a deckhand. And then I found a company in my hometown, Pensacola, where I lived, and they had tugboats, and they were running all over the Caribbean and to Mexico and stuff like that. So I started doing that. And the first foreign trip I ever made was to Port-au-Prince, Haiti. And I was a deckhand on a tugboat, and we towed a couple of barges full of care packages from the United States to the Haitian government. We towed that down there. We were docked there for like a month because it was their It took them, their equipment was so antiquated, They had to do everything by hand. Anyway, but I know you didn't want to hear about that.
No, that's interesting. The background's important. The background's important because you are working on in commercial shipping, right? And you start going international. International. So this starts happening about when? And like, where are you going? Like you said, Haiti.
1981.
Okay, cool. And so, and you picked up an interesting trade while you were visiting some of these offshore ports, as I understand it.
Yeah.
Is that correct?
All right. Well, see, when I first started, I learned one thing. They taught me one thing. You know how marijuana, if you have like for chemotherapy patients and stuff like that, it reduces the nausea.
Yeah.
Well, guess what? Works on seasickness too.
Oh.
So I get on these boats and all these people on there, they brought weed with them to smoke. And that's before they did the just say no shit and the zero tolerance. So everybody, it was literally the high seas. You know, we get on there, smoke, have a good time. Right?
Of course, why not? You know, you're not going to run into anything. Yeah, that's great.
We went down to Haiti on that first trip, and we needed weed. So that was the first place I ever did a drug deal in a foreign country. But like I said in my thing, I was never like a cartel mule or anything. It was just for me and my friends to get high.
Yeah.
And so we'd go down there and we'd get weed whenever we were in Haiti. And then we went other places like Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, you know, Bahamas. And you know, wherever we stopped that, we'd just find weed and stuff like that and buy it. And then we'd bring it back. And then customs had come aboard, but they never paid much attention to us. It was just like, you know, we'd stash it because those boats are 100-foot long. So you can stash shit real easy.
Right.
And so it's hard to bring dogs on boats. When you got big ships, it's a lot easier. But when on these boats, they're too so confined. So they didn't pay much attention to us because, you know, they knew we weren't like big time smugglers.
Right.
You know, this was a legit company with contracts and everything like that. And so I did that for the first few years while I was a deckhand. And then I worked my way up and became an officer. And once I became an officer, I got a uniform and it's a set of Navy khakis. And so once I put that officer's uniform on, I could go through customs just like that. Nobody would even give me a second look. So I did that once I became an officer. I worked my way up to captain, and I was captain for 15 years. And I brought all the drugs back that I wanted because nobody, and I ain't talking just marijuana. I'm talking hashish. I'm talking cocaine. I never smuggled heroin because that's a really big sentence. The rest of them you can get away with.
Right.
But I did it for the whole 20 years. I was in the Merchant Marine, and I never got caught one time. Came close a few times. I was on a ship with a couple of guys that got caught in the Ivory Coast, but I never got caught. And so I took some writing classes. I live in Hollywood, by the way. Yeah. And so I took some writing classes, and I wrote my final project in this writing class. I wrote a story about smuggling hashish out of Morocco and how we got it and smuggled it and everything. I got 100 on the story, of course, and I got 100 for the course. But the teacher sent me an email, professor. It was a Southern New Hampshire University. Mm-hmm. He sent me an email and it said, "Why you took this writing course, I don't know." He goes, "You're so advanced. This was way beyond this type of course." He goes, "But I do want to say one thing to you." He goes, "When you win your Academy Award, please remember me in your acceptance speech." And it was literally a story about smuggling hashish out of Morocco.
So you eventually, you work your way up the chain of command, if you will. And now you're going... You mentioned Morocco, like you were starting in the Caribbean, but you went overseas.
Oh, yeah, I went all over the world.
Yeah.
I did it everywhere.
And so when you're buying for like recreational use, right, mm-hmm. you're taking it back. Now, conceptually, and I know enough to be dangerous about this, but you come back and customs almost always checks the boat, right? Mm-hmm. But to your point, as like the captain or an officer on the boat, you weren't like a high value target. Like no one would suspect you otherwise know or want to really like get in your way because you're the guy who's in charge of the boat anyway. And why would you be this big time smuggler? Is that a fair statement?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So you do this, but you still have to get off the boat, right? The ship.
Yeah.
And you still have to go through customs. So, and this is the 80s and 90s, right? So it's like, mm-hmm. not like it is today, but you just get ushered through.
It was a lot easier back then because 9-1-1 hadn't happened yet.
Yeah.
And, you know, they hadn't blown too many planes up and ships and stuff. I did it by plane and ship because sometimes we'd take a ship to a location like, well, Malta was the location. Yeah. Took the ship from Corpus Christi to the Mediterranean to Malta. And then we delivered the ship there for that ship to work in the oil field off the coast of Malta. And then the crew flew back to the United States from Malta. And I actually was highish. When we left Malta, I got hash in Malta too. And we flew Air Malta from Valletta, Malta to Schiphol Airport in Amsterdam. And I walked through customs wearing my khakis and had ounces of hash in my bag. They looked at me, just waved me through.
Now, do you sense that they thought you were in the military or did they just assume you were just somebody and they said they don't?
But the Merchant Marine wasn't military.
Yeah, yeah. Right. Well, at the time.
Commercial shipping.
Yeah, right. Right. At the time, it wasn't. Exactly. It had been, but it was not. That's interesting. So, you know, in terms of like getting caught, you know, how often were you doing this? Like, I mean, you know, like, you know, obviously you do things more often, right? Like it tends to like ratchet up like the opportunity because your risk just goes with repetition, right? So in terms of like your activity, like how busy were you? You know, I mean, how many trips would you take in a year? How many, like, you know, what was like your...
Oh, I worked 10 months a year.
Oh, okay.
But see, some of these trips, you'd go from point A to point B. It might take you, you might be at sea for a month.
Yeah.
And you gotta depending, have you know, yeah. crossing the Atlantic or the Pacific or whatever. And so you might be at sea for a month. And then you'd hang out in the country for a while, depending on whether you were coming back on the ship or it was just a straight delivery job.
Right.
I delivered ships to Africa, Rio de Janeiro, Malta, let's see, San Francisco to Hawaii, Hawaii to Tokyo, or not Tokyo, Yokohama, and came back.
Well, it begs the question then too, right? Like, if you're engaged in this and you're dropping off in like places like Rio, which are rough places, like, don't, you know, make no mistake, they're rough places. How do you find the drugs? I mean, what would you do? Like, you know, you're in Malta, you found drugs. You were in Morocco, you found drugs. I mean, how were you able to sort of navigate this to where you always had a source in literally every geographical location on the planet? That to me is amazing, right?
I got to tell you the best story. The one I wrote that for that writing class.
Mm-hmm.
We pull in, we leave Charleston. Ship's called the Doc Express, Texas. The story's called, did you ever see that movie Midnight Express?
Yeah, sure.
Okay. When I saw that movie in 1978, I knew when I saw that movie, I would do that, not go to prison.
Right.
And I hope you know the movie was bullshit. It wasn't the truth about what happened.
Yeah.
The guy didn't kill a guard and escape like that. That was all bullshit.
Right.
If you Google it, you can read the real story. And Nat Geo did the real story. It's called The Real Midnight Express on Locked Up Abroad.
Oh, okay.
You can see the real story. Oliver Stone rewrote that script completely. It was a novel.
Right.
And then he rewrote it. And they made it what they wanted it to be.
Right.
But anyway, we leave Charleston. We get to Ceuta, Morocco. We pull in there. And we've only got one day liberty in Morocco. So me and two of my buddies, we get off the ship. Walk outside the port facility, we hail a cab, get in the cab, and we're in Spanish Morocco. So the first thing I do is tell the guy, quiero voy a la casa de puta, want to go to the whorehouse.
Right.
Because we'd been at sea for a month, right? And this guy, you're going to love this. He goes, what the fuck are you talking to me like that for? I speak English in the thickest Bronx accent you've ever fucking heard. And I was like, what? I was like, you're from New York? He goes, hell yeah. I was born and raised in the United States. And I'm like, what are you doing here? He goes, that's right. Where my family's from. Anyway, the guy was so cool. He says, you're not going to get in the whorehouse. And I go, it was like 6 a.m. He goes, you're not going to get in the whorehouse. And I'm like, bullshit. I got money. I'm getting in the whorehouse. Well, he was right. They wouldn't open the fucking door. And I'm holding a $100 bill.
Yeah.
I couldn't believe it. So we're like, fuck, what are we going to do? And I was like, hey, you think you can score some hashish? Hell yeah, no problem. How much you want?
That's open at 6 a.m. Yeah.
It's like that. And that was how we did it. Sometimes if I couldn't get a cab driver to do it, I'd get a prostitute to score the drugs.
Right. Right.
It was easy.
Really? That's fascinating. Absolutely fascinating. And you did this all over the world.
All over the world.
So what made you quit?
Oh, Jay, exactly what made me quit. In 1993, I married a crazy stripper.
Wow.
And she freaking, we were together for like 5 years. And we had a son together. And she wanted to go back to stripping. And I was like, I'm not going to be married to you if you're going to strip, bitch. You know? I make good money and she could do what she wanted because I was on the boat all the time. Right.
Right.
And so I was like, but if you're going to be doing that shit, we're getting a divorce. Well, she knew she could never get custody of our child, but I didn't even want custody because I worked on a ship. What am I going to do with him? So let him stay with his mother. Anyways, bitch pulls a gun on me. We're in Miami, Florida, pulls a gun on me. We're at home. I call the cops. The cops show up, her and her mother lie and say, I pulled the gun on her. I got charged with ag assault with a firearm.
Oh, wow.
And so they offered me, I did a little time in jail trying to beat the case, and they offered me credit time serving. I was like, fuck you. I didn't do it. We're going to trial.
Yeah.
I lost the trial. And in Florida, it's a 3-year minimum mandatory.
Right.
And so I got sent to prison. I appealed the conviction. 10 months later, I'm released on the appeal. I got a full reversal.
Oh.
I'm released on the appeal. And we went back to trial again, and I beat the case in a second trial. But when I took that felony conviction from the first trial, they said, there goes your captain's license. But when I beat it, they came back and said, hey, if you want to do 10 years probation, we'll let you have the license back. And I was like, fuck you. I didn't do it. I'm not doing it.
Right. Why would I?
And they're like, no, that's the only way we're going to get your license.
That's a lot of effort, man. 10 years probation. 2 years probation is a lot of effort.
Exactly.
Yeah. Yeah. Most people.
And I got a lot more trouble after that.
Yeah.
I don't know. Can you see the scars on the top of my head?
Yeah.
That was from the police in Texas. That's how I ended up out here in California. It was, I did a drug deal in Houston, and then I'd already picked up, it was just like a quarter ounce of coke. And I was coming back to pick up a girl who I dropped off. And I went through this neighborhood in Houston called Club Creek. They actually called it Club Crack. And it was, if a white guy was in that neighborhood at night, it was either a drug deal or a prostitution deal.
Right.
And so the cops saw me cutting through, and all I was doing was cutting through because I already had the coke. And so I'm cutting through. Cops see me. They lit me up. And Houston police in 2004, they shot six people in their car and killed them. And so it was at night. I'm in my car. It's misty rain. And I was just like, fuck that. I'm not going to get shot. I'm going somewhere. Not on where I didn't pull over on a dark street in the hood. Right.
Right.
And so I got off on a freeway feeder road to go to a gas station that was well lit. And then I saw the cops wasn't behind me. I was like, fuck, I beat them. So I fucking jump on the freeway, but I didn't know there was a chopper above.
Yeah.
And so the chopper followed me, told the cops exactly where I was at. I eventually, they cornered me in a cul-de-sac. And when I went into it was like the street was like a circle.
Yeah.
I went into the circle. I did a 180 to head back out because it was houses in front of me, right?
Yeah.
And then two cops come past me. They did 180s. They're behind me. Two cops come forward and they're in front of me. But they parked on, they pulled up on either side of the curb, right? So the whole middle of the street was open. So I was like, well, if you're that stupid, fuck you. So I drove out. And all this is on TV when it happened.
Oh, yeah. There you go.
So these cops look like idiots. And so about 15 minutes later, the car skidded. I hit a freaking medium. I couldn't drive the car anymore. I jumped out, started running, and I ran down this embankment. And at the bottom of it was like mud and a marsh and shit like that. And so I get down there and I can't run anymore because it's like quicksand. And so I was like, okay, I give up. I turned around, raised my hands, and I got all these laser sights dancing on my chest. So I'm like, oh, fuck, the bullet's about to fly. And freaking, I was lucky they didn't fire.
Yeah.
But anyway, the cop comes down. He pulls me out of the fucking marsh. And when they got me on the shore, it was like pitch black down there. You couldn't see anything. So there were some other cops there. They started beating the shit out of me. And that's how I got traumatic brain injury out of it and everything. Wow. And when I got out of jail, oh, and that's another story. I was a drug dealer in Harris County Jail, honest to God. And yeah, they locked me up and I get in the in jail, right? And there was this kid in there who was a drug dealer, and he was illiterate. He was like a 20 something black kid, and he was illiterate. And so he came to me and he asked me, he says, look, he goes, if you can write these requests to the psychiatrist, we can get drugs in here, which the county will pay for.
Yeah.
And we can sell the drugs to the other prisoners. And he goes, we'll live like kings in here. And I'm like, sure, no problem. Yeah. So I write up a medical request for both of us. We both get to see the shrink. And they gave us each prescriptions for a drug called Seroquel.
Yeah.
And it's an antipsychotic. Are you familiar with that?
Yeah, sure. It's an antipsychotic.
Okay. Antipsychotic.
Yeah.
Makes you sleep.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Man, those things are the most valuable shit you can get in a jail. And so the whole time I was in jail on that evading arrest charge, I was a freaking kingpin in Harris County Jail selling the Seroquel to the other guys.
You took what you learned on the high seas and transferred it to Harris County Jail. That's really cool. Well, listen, I appreciate the story, man. It's a wild one. Your story is a movie. Your professor was right. This is like multiple movies, perhaps. I appreciate it, and best of luck in all your future endeavors. And to all my listeners, this is the Adam Tracy Underground Podcast. Check us out on SoundCloud and wherever podcasts are found, and we will talk to you next episode.
Thank you for listening to the Adam Tracy Underground Podcast. For more episodes, visit us at adamtracy.io or your leading podcast providers.